Welcome back in the studio. I'm Todd Rundgren with Redbeard.
You have, and have on this list, been involved directly in 22 albums in 17 years. Some of those were doubles. At least one was live, but still, 22 albums mm-hmm. in 17 years. And I think they left one off. So
maybe.
plus, you've produced countless others in the same period.
Mm-hmm.
That's an amazing body of work.
It's a body of work, yeah.
That's a big body.
That's fairly, you know, that's without high, steroids. Well, most of what I've done, you know, it's amazing to think that there were some periods in my life when I didn't do hardly any music. It's been 4 years since I've had an album out.
That's the other weird thing, was that at times it seems that you disappear for long periods, but you couldn't have. I mean, since 1968, there's been an album every single year. Some years there were two.
Mm-hmm.
Only between Tortured Artist and Acapella was there even like an 18-month period. It's unbelievable. Prolific, I don't think is adequate. I think that's an inadequate term. I don't know.
Well, a lot of it is. Some of it, if we discount the production and just count the stuff that I'm involved in, and just think Rhino Records got all of it. what a lump to swallow. But most all of the albums are the result of some kind of musical adventure. It's a privilege that a lot of people don't enjoy. I very early on in my recording career decided that I had too many things I wanted to explore to be uncertain about my environment. So I immediately after like my third album, as soon as I made any kind of money, I built a recording studio and have had my own recording studio ever since. So
that was very rare back then for the performer.
I suppose so, you know, yeah. But I was doing production as well, so it made a certain degree of sense. But also I was really fascinated. One of the things that got me into it was quad, you know. I was thinking, I want a quad studio so I can make three-dimensional music. And even though I think we tried to set up my first studio as quad, we really didn't have that much, you know, quad stuff to do, but... Just the that got me into having a studio and being able to be essentially a musical adventurer, to just pick a concept or an avenue of music that I wanted to explore, or any, you know, a handful of different ideas, and just be able to go in and have the technology to realize it was always seemed a privilege to me. You know, whenever I was involved in it, I've always felt really sort of fortunate. And at a certain point where you realize, God, this is a lot of fun. You know, this is, there are sometimes also in the same process where you think I've really bitten off more than I can chew, or I'm drying up, or some, you know, you always have these phases, ups and downs that you go through in the process. But one of the distinct feelings that I've always had is what a privilege it is, you know, and how I'm going to do it for as long as I have an opportunity to do it.
The sound of my voice, I am
only reason why I've slowed down in my output recently is because I've had a little bit of a philosophical reordering of priorities in terms of my own records, and that is that I want to make a much more serious consideration of the projects that I'm going to be involved in and invest a lot more of myself in them. Whereas I could come out with records probably much more quickly before, because my objectives were not always concrete. I was looking at each record in some ways as an experiment. You know, I would kind of like outline a concept for myself, but then say, well, anything that happens within the confines of this general idea is okay. After Acapella, which I was fairly happy with, I got offered the opportunity to write a musical for the New York Shakespeare Festival, write the music for it. And it started to put things in a different time frame. You know, this is a cooperative effort, so I can't be purely experimental. And you have other priorities. You know, you have to make the music immediately memorable, things like that. So I started getting more into detail and refining of the concept and making my considerations a little bit more finite. Probably, you know, spend a little bit more time. It'll be a little bit longer between records, only because I'm just taking the process. I'm having a different attitude about the process, which requires me to spend a little bit more time refining my concepts before I actually go into the studio. That's one reason why this last album took so long. I've never taken 6 months to make a record. And it's not that it took 6 months to make it. It's just that we would record, you know, it averaged out about a song a month. You know, that sometimes I would have to go away and do something. I wouldn't record a song for a couple months. Then I would come back and then I would do, like three songs in 3 weeks. But on average, it took 6 months. The reason being is that the confines, the strictures of the concept required me to consider the kind of material that I was writing much more stringently. You know, I had to have to consider whether it's performable within the period of time. Can people learn it and perform it within a 10-hour period? You know, if not, well, I have to change the concept. Then again, I don't want it to be simple-minded. You know, it has to be
not done by rote.
No, it still has to be a musical challenge, or else it won't. People won't be piqued enough. So the songwriting aspect of it. The coherence of the album as a whole was a factor. So the songwriting aspect of it became a lot more critical. Even the way that I did it was different than I historically do it. Since I used to do everything myself, I never did demos for records. I would just go in and do them. I would just go in and...
You never did demos?
No, I never
did. Even for yourself?
No, not for my own records, because I'm going to play it all anyway. You know, so I just play it the way I want it. I know the techniques of the studio well enough that there's no reason for me to do it like rough. You know, I can just do it in what is intended to be a final form. But the ultimate effect of that process was that I didn't usually write the lyrics to the song until everything else was done. Like, I would record the entire track and then I would actually write the song part of it. It's different the way most people do, but the elements in it are the same. I mean, they sit down at the piano, work out some changes, maybe some little melodic ideas, and then they add words to them. You know, the idea that that somebody sits down and just like comes out with a fully realized song, that happens very rarely.
Right.
So I was doing this interactively in the studio. It was an interactive process with the machines. You know, like I would work out the keyboard part. If it didn't feel right to me, then I would change it. If I thought it was rhythmically not interesting enough, then I'd go back and make refinements in the rhythm part. But this all would be recorded at the same time.
A million old soldiers will fade away, but a dream goes on forever. I'm left standing here, I got nothing to say. All is silent within my dreams. A thousand true loves who wouldn't die, but a dream lives on forever. time has stopped in my dream. We all have our everyday hopes and fears, and you'll find no exception in me. But that doesn't get me through a sea of tears over life's biggest tragedy.
Welcome back in the studio. I'm Todd Rundgren with Redbeard.
Isn't there some inherent danger? If I mean, you're a producer and a performer,
mm-hmm.
and a songwriter and an arranger and a player. Now, if you were working with anybody else except yourself,
mm-hmm.
would you stand for that? Would you put it
No.
out?
Well, the point is, I never asked anybody else to participate in the process with me.
But
so it wasn't
okay,
a question me, of
okay.
you know
well,
some
that's a, that's
of me having to satisfy a producer,
right,
you know,
that's
in
a
the first place.
Or a time, professional courtesy time constraint.
The thing is, if I decided that I wanted to have somebody produce my record, if I should do that, you know, say I really admired somebody's work and I didn't want to have to think about anything except performing it. I would certainly expect that I would have to demo the songs then for the producer in order for him to be oriented. Otherwise, what is his job? You know.
Okay.
In that sense, no. As a producer, I wouldn't go into the studio just on faith. You know.
So in cutting your own albums over the years, isn't there some inherent danger in getting kind of lost in the soup if you keep kind of adding new ingredients and another spice thing and everything like that? Do you have the chance or the danger of losing the focus of the track or the feel?
I suppose for some people this may be true, but for somebody who's supposed to be a producer, one of the qualities that qualifies you as a producer is your discrimination, is your ability to be not necessarily objective. I don't think there's such a thing in music except, you know, for the purely technical part of it, but for your ability to be consistently subjective, you know, to be
I like that.
You know, to have an opinion and a perception that at least can be counted on to not to swerve around for unreasonable, you know, for no good reason. For instance, an artist by rights temperamental can come in a bad mood someday and say, and listen to the track they did the day before and say, oh, that's awful, you know, that sucks. But your job as a producer is to either confirm or deny that, you know, based on a more dispassionate criteria, let's say. Part of being a producer is just constantly being aware of what matters.
When I was a child, thought as a child, spoke as a child, I didn't know better. But now I'm a man, look like a man. Oh, there's a man. There's a real man, a real man. Forget about my body and be a real man. I see with my heart, hear with my heart, I feel with my heart. Sometimes it looks like inside me. There's a real man, a real man. Forget about bad feelings and be a real man. Something untold with only 8 of 20. Afraid of everything and I laugh at nothing. And they it's a real man.
Are you still the only producer for you?
Well, considering the way that I work, it'd be very difficult, nearly inconsiderate, you know, to in some instances to involve another person.
Just not a 9-to-5 gig. Huh?
Yeah, it's not the things that I expect as a producer. You know, from an artist, I could say that, you know, some of them I may not be prepared to deliver, and as an artist, you know, to a producer, there are a number of elements, you know, to consider. There's, you know, if it's not broke, don't fix it idea. Unless I feel that there's something wrong, then there's the only reason for me to try that is out of idle curiosity, something like that. But the biggest mistake an artist can make, biggest mistake a record company can make, is to hire a producer when the artist doesn't want one. You know, for the artist to pretend that they will allow somebody to produce their record and then try and take rest control back now in the middle of the process, because it's happened to me a number of times. And sometimes you weather it, sometimes you don't. Sometimes you never finish the project.
Wow.
Sometimes you weather through the project, and then you have to endure all this, you know.
Not being.
Sometimes the end result won't be as good. Sometimes it will, in spite of the process, be good. But you never work with the artist again, you know. It's that. So, yeah, there should be a real understanding that if you're going to have a producer involved in the record, then his name is on the record just like yours. His reputation is on the line. He's going to have an opinion. You know, he's going to want to, you know, have some influence in the way the record turns out. So no one should hire a producer without the full intention of involving them in the process. And to that extent, I have no desire to at this point, or don't see the necessity to have someone else help me develop the concept.
I've been burned in my pride. The simple things in life seem so hard to learn sometimes, and it takes so long. Catch it while you can. Too late tomorrow, and
two decades,
mm-hmm.
sometimes two in a year.
Mm-hmm.
That's, I don't know anybody, I can't think of anybody else that's done that. And
yeah.
if they just, maybe.
Elvis Costello has exceeded that already. Elvis Costello has exceeded that output
wow.
in terms of being prolific. It's not that, you know, not that, although I don't see any reason why not, you know, I should put myself in the same class, you know, but the idea that, you know, that you have to dry up, you know, or conversely, that you have to be constantly stylistically relevant to whatever the market happens to be at the time.
You know,
the inference being that, I have some desire for commercial success, that has been reflected unsuccessfully in my records, and that is not true. And
has
B,
that never been a consideration?
No, it's never been. You know, and at this point, it was not a consideration either. as I said, that, you know, if that was a prime consideration, I probably wouldn't have gone to the trouble to do it the way I did.
Good point.
Know? And as a matter of fact, when I delivered Ruffs to Warner Brothers, they were extremely apprehensive.
Not turning flip-flops, huh?
No, they
wheels.
Just because the sound was too different. You know, the sound was much more raw. You know, by the time I got to mixing it, it sounds a lot more contemporary-ish, you know, but when I gave them the roughs before they were, you know, before everything was edited together, like they didn't know whether that was the concept. So it wasn't until the album was completed that my intentions at least were revealed. But there may have been an element in terms of my entire approach to have the album accepted by Warner Brothers rather, and I wanted to start the arrangement off on at least a cooperative note. So I wanted them to accept the album. Whether it becomes wildly commercially successful, I have no idea.
Take it to Paris.
it's just nice to be on a label that will consider promoting record, finding out what the possibilities are, as opposed to my previous label. There's always the possibility that I would have sold far more records on a label that was a little more oriented towards promotion of the records, particularly as we know, us insiders, how the record independent promotion thing has been working. And unfortunately, I was on a label that had a 50-50 promotional arrangement with their distributor. It was distributed by Warner Brothers, but it was Bearsville Records. And Bearsville was essentially run by one guy, Albert Grossman. And their arrangement was, in any records that got released, they would have to do a 50-50 promotional thing. In other words, Warner's wouldn't spend 50%, 50 cents out of a dollar, unless Bearsville did. So since Bearsville didn't spend any, that meant no promotion. No promotional was ever expended on any of the records, you know. And full page ads aside, there's the invisible side of promoting a record.
Oh, absolutely.
So in any case, there's always the possibility that one of those records in there was that record, you know.
Oh, no, there were several.
Yeah.
There were several.
There were, you know, there were several. There were ones that they even knew after the fact, you know, and then we get into this kind of like stupid admissions about, oh, we should have broken that record. We could have broken that record.
A lot of good, but does.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's, you know, it doesn't make much difference. So subsequently, I'm not an artist who really puts a lot of commercial consideration into my records anyway, because I have no expectations on those lines. My records are of just a reflection of what I think about what I'm interested in. And I have a hardcore audience who is interested in the same things and interested in what I have to say about them. And that's what's kept me in the record business. I don't kid myself. You know, if I sell a million records tomorrow, it won't be because a million people bought the record. It'll be because those 100,000 people kept me alive until then. You know, they kept me in the studio until that happened. Yeah. And I have no intention of, you know, just gratuitously ignoring what kept me going this long.
Can't play this game anymore, but can we still be friends? Things just can't go. Now it's time for the wheel to turn.
this used to be the way records were recorded 20, 30 years ago.
How are they?
Well, probably people don't realize that most records are done with the minimum amount of musicians in the studio at the same time. They're essentially overdubbed, most records. It's a philosophy of record making. After all, the technology made it possible. The intention of multi-track recording technology wasn't necessarily to encourage overdubbing, but to give you a greater degree of isolation when it came time to either to make repairs or to mix the final product. So what's happened is that through a combination of this and other technical advances, there is an increasing degree of isolation in terms of the performances that each player on the record might deliver.
What does that do to the end product?
Well, what's happened is that there's this performance element that used to be in records that has slowly been sort of like winnowed out of records to a point that people don't notice anymore. They don't perceive the fact that there's this really kind of like sterile quality about the way the music is performed. So the idea of making this record in this particular way was to take the approach to write the material in a certain way and to record it in a certain way so as to force a performance out of it, more or less. To write the material in some cases in a way that would make it more difficult to overdub than to do it all live.
It may burst, but I'll